Well, we have an epidemic underway here in the United States. There's a very large outbreak in Seattle. That's the one we know about. Probably one in Santa Clara, maybe other parts of the country, other cities. And so we're past the point of containment. We have to implement broad mitigation strategies. The next 2 weeks are really going to change the complexion in this country. We'll get through this, but it's going to be a hard period. We're looking at 2 months, probably of difficulty. To give you a basis of comparison, 2 weeks ago, Italy had 9 cases. 95% of all their cases have been diagnosed in the last 10 days. For South Korea, 85% of all their cases have been diagnosed in the last 10 days. We're entering that period right now of rapid acceleration. And the sooner we can implement tough mitigation steps in places where we have outbreaks, like Seattle, the lower the scope of the epidemic here.
That was former Trump administration Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb talking about coronavirus on Face the Nation Sunday. In the 24 hours since those comments, we've seen global financial markets tank, Senator Ted Cruz and Representative Paul Gosar go into self-quarantine, and the closure of Columbia University in New York, among many other institutions. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Did I do it right, Catherine?
You did. Thank you.
Thank you. It's not very easy to do. Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Uh-oh.
Hey, Matt.
It begins. So let's get a Monday morning snapshot of where we all are with this pandemic. I think we're calling it that. The United States has shifted from containment to mitigation, as the hyper-caffeinated Scott Gottlieb just mentioned. We have quarantines and states of emergency being declared from coast to coast. Worldwide, there have been more than 100,000 cases, just a little bit less than 4,000 deaths. Cases outside China have tripled since the last time the four of us were on a teleconference podcast. Italy has placed 1/4 of its population on lockdown. Iran has released 70,000 prisoners rather than staying inside and infecting each other. Here at home, at least 564 people have tested positive across 34 states, although about half of that is in New York, California, and Washington. 22 have died, mostly in Washington state. One positive case attended CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which has sent a kind of transitive property freak out across official Washington, where people like Cruz may have been exposed or are worried about it. And I just saw across our feeds here that a D.C. priest has been diagnosed with coronavirus, who offered communion and shook hands with more than 500 worshipers. He laughing at the communion coronavirus, wow. Nick Gillespie.
Well, I'm just saying that's like a mythic kind of means of transmission, whether you take it in your hand, as was introduced post-Vatican II, or directly on the tongue.
It was not a Catholic church, just for the record.
We can have communion.
Where the hell was he serving the communion?
It's Georgetown, as a matter of fact.
Georgetown is Catholic. Where was this church? Who is this man?
See, it's called the Christ Church, Nick. You have to fact check the denominations. Before, this is the reason why those of us who attend Catholic Church but have never been baptized are not going to get the virus there. Let's peek in. Tap, 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 tap. Oh, Jesus. Dow Jones Industrial Average.
The ticker tape.
Ticker tape.
Down
as of 11:05 a.m. Eastern, 6.65%.
God, Matt.
We are getting down to, it's going to be very close to actual bear market territory for the first time in a decade. Might happen even today. And I think all U.S. bonds of any duration are all below 1%, which is financial traderies for, dude, I am so scared about the coming recession. So, Catherine, before we get into official responses and government policies and all that kind of stuff, I just want to talk about your own internal conflicts, because on the one hand, you're obviously an emotionless robot spitting out probability statistics and so forth and mocking the panic of the person sitting across from you in that small booth. On the other, you understand exponential reasoning. And still, most importantly, you don't want to have to watch your damn kids when they start closing all the schools in D.C. Where are you in your sense, in your conflicts with all these things right now?
Yeah, I mean, you gave a pretty darn good summary of where I'm at, and I feel seen, which I appreciate. So, yeah, I mean, I maintain a certain amount of chill, which some of my compatriots here on this very podcast, I think, would doubt or think is somewhat misguided. I remain hopeful that our medical system will be strong enough to handle the cases that do become critical, and that on that side of things, we will be okay. I remain, as always, deeply pessimistic about our politics, and in particular, our public schools and their ability to handle pressure. So, for instance, here in Washington, D.C., where sometimes it rains and they close the schools.
Yeah.
I just don't feel very confident that we will be able to do a good risk assessment about exposure and community dynamics and trade-offs for economic purposes. And I think instead that at some point someone will semi-irrationally freak out and close the schools. And that's how it will happen. It will not happen for good reasons. This will be true of many institutions across the board. Now, there is theoretically some math that some people somewhere could do, but it will, of course, always have to factor in public sentiment, that terrifying beast. And so that is where we are. I have faith in individual people. I have minimal to no faith in institutions and groups.
In collective people.
I know as somebody who sent their kids to Montgomery County Public Schools, which is adjacent to D.C., they were, you know, on Thursday nights, if there was a snow forecast, a dusting forecast for Monday, they would shut the schools down. So I see it coming. But Catherine, here's a question that may have an actual answer to, but I doubt it. Is there any kind of known formula to say when a certain number of cases are reported, given the population of the school district or something like that, that's when they shut it down? And do you think does that exist? And then if there is something like that was made public, do you think that would be a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, I tend to think it would be a good thing, right?
Yeah.
To make it
so
kind of transparent.
I actually, right before we started taping this podcast, essentially asked Reason Science correspondent Ron Bailey that very question. Are there any key learnings, as they say in the corporate world, that we could take away from past epidemics or pandemics, particularly those here in the United States, in terms of what best practices are? But I think the thing that you were hinting at, Nick, which is very important, is it doesn't matter that much where we set the triggers. What would be very valuable is for them to be known and somewhat uniform. Now, this, of course, is a tricky question in our system, which has lots of discretion for individual states and districts. And those of us, I think, on this podcast and many of our listeners have a healthy skepticism of the idea that the federal government should step in and overrule those protections. But as Scott Gottlieb actually went on to say in the rest of the interview that this show started with, there is theoretically a role for the federal government, and one that I am not particularly troubled by as a libertarian, to provide guidance and to provide carrots, right? So basically to say, hey, here are a bunch of—
Not celery. Not broccoli.
Fuck celery.
Not broccoli.
Not asparagus.
Broccoli is off the menu.
Carrots.
Baby carrots and maybe some of those little sweet peppers that are super good for snacking too.
Strongly disagree. Full-size carrots are better than baby carrots.
What about apple slices, maybe with a caramel
little
dip?
Peanut butter?
That seems to be very popular among school kids in particular.
Okay. So basically the federal government could say, hey, here's a bunch of suggested cutoffs. Here's a bunch of places where we see some thresholds. Y'all are still in charge of your own stuff, but here's some ideas. And then to say, here's some support for implementing those things, whether it's money, whether it's, you know, logistical support, whatever it is. To me, that is a possibility that is consonant with a skepticism of government, that is consonant with the American system, as I understand it, and that would probably be better than our status quo. That is not happening, in part because politics are bad, and in particular, our current politics are tribal and partisan and bad in ways that are interfering with some of that.
Well, also, yeah. I mean, you also have white issues with the White House.
Can this be the squid invasion that?
I know. I'm having a lot of big
Watchmen
feels here.
Paul Krugman.
Yeah.
You know,
zombies.
Maybe this is what brings us together.
I think that the answer to Nick's actual question there is the number one.
right? If there is one case, positive case, or even a suspicion of a case, a kid, a child of someone who is tested positive, then that school is going to close, right? I mean, that's basically what happened in Columbia. Columbia University wasn't even a student, yeah. I don't think. As soon as there's one person, like one of the first cases that was diagnosed here in New York City was of a guy, I think, who works in Manhattan, and his kids go to school in Riverdale and in Westchester. Mm-hmm. Forgive me if I get that wrong. And so as soon as he was tested positive, it's like that school closed. And that's how it's going to go. And I got no problem with that. You know, I mean, the kids are probably going to be fine for the most part, but they will spread the thing around. And it's the olds, like certain people on this podcast, who are the most susceptible to it. And so that's how it's going to happen. Peter, I tasked you with answering one question, and I want you to answer it. But before I actually get you to answer that question, you live in D.C. You are not exposed to kids because you hate them. You are exposed to 200-pound dogs. What in, now that there's like one, maybe two, cases in D.C., what is your basic personal level of panic and doom? And then I'll ask you a policy question afterwards.
I've definitely stockpiled a little bit of food and planned for extended disruptions. Because I think
what bitters do you lay in on?
All
Peter,
of them? The bitters? Also, he can make those if shit gets real.
Although it does require... I don't know what the supply line issues are in terms of ordering obscure roots from Amazon, which is necessary for making your own bitters. So I'm planning for an extended period not of quarantine, but of mass closures. I think that in coming weeks, it's at least reasonably likely, not certain, but reasonably likely that major population centers, including Washington, D.C., are going to be not fully shut down, but somewhat empty. People are going to stay home from work. A lot of places are going to close, certainly public gathering places. People are going to reduce unnecessary travel outside of the home. And some of that's going to be driven by policy decisions. A lot of it's going to be driven by employers who are going to look and say, either people aren't coming into my shop, so there's no point in opening it up, or I can't bring people in here because it would be irresponsible. We've already started to see that with conferences. South by Southwest in particular is sort of the, not quite patient zero on this, but sort of the biggest example in terms of conferences shutting down. South by Southwest is gigantic, and it is a huge part of Austin's economy, and they just decided not to have it, basically at the last minute this year. And that's driven partly by the organizers feeling like it would be irresponsible to bring in people from all over the world and have them all milling around in the same space. But it's also driven by the fact that a lot of the sponsors, the people who would be paying for events, who would be showing films, who would be doing whatever it is that they're doing at this conference, which is a sort of mega conference that covers a whole bunch of things, including politics and policy and tech and film and music and all of this stuff. People who would be participating in it are looking and saying, actually, I don't want to send my people to this conference. Actually, I don't want to be part of this. Actually, I think that this would be a bad idea. You see Harvard University basically saying no international travel, no business travel. We strongly discourage even personal travel. And I think that sort of thing is going to spread pretty quickly here as the number of cases rise, which they have been, as Matt said, all week, and are nearly certain, virtually certain to continue rising in coming weeks. So I am, in fact, planning just for the likelihood that I'm going to be stuck at home, self-quarantining, self-quarantine and chill here, right? It's like it's Netflix and coronavirus for the next couple of weeks. And in fact, and so the other thing is, we talked about risk, and I think people need to sort of think a little bit differently about risk here. On the one hand, as Matt said, this is the highest risk by far is to seniors and to the elderly. You see, with people over 70 or 80, it's something like 8 or 10% fatality rates for people who actually get who are diagnosed with coronavirus. That's very high. But then people are doing this thing where they're looking and they're saying, oh, well, for people in their 30s and their 40s, the risk is, say, 0.4% or 0.3%. But think about what that means. If it's a 1 in 250 or 1 in 500 chance, or even let's say it's a 0.1% chance, 1 in 1,000, that if you get coronavirus, you'll die, right? And that's what it is for people in their, that's a sort of conservative or sort of low end for people maybe in their 20s or early 30s. Think about Disneyland. About 56,000 people go to Disneyland on average every single day. If 56 of them were dying, would you go to Disneyland? Would you be like, eh, that's not that big a deal? You wouldn't. No one would think that. In fact, Disneyland would shut down immediately within hours if anybody thought that was happening. And so that's the low risk, is the equivalent of Disneyland killing 56 people every single day. And so I do think people need to be genuinely cautious about this and not sort of say, it's not a big deal, not kind of say, well, you know, I'm not going to prepare and I'm not going to think about this, because the risks are real and the risks are most significant for the elderly. And that's, in fact, why they are one of the reasons why they're shutting down businesses, why they're shutting down schools, is because you spread it around and yes, it might not affect children or it might not affect, you know, young people who are relatively healthy all that much. But the more it spreads, the more it has a chance to, say, get into a nursing home, the more it has a chance to get to your elderly relatives who may have respiratory issues. And that's who's really affected here. And frankly, like, if you want to draw this out to a sort of really weird and horrific conclusion, it is a problem right now that the three people who are most likely to be the next president of the United States are all 70 plus years old. And they have all spent the last couple of months, at least two of them have spent the last couple of months running around the country, shaking hands. And the other one, even still, like even Donald Trump, who is not out, you know, campaigning in the Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden style, goes around the country and meets a lot of people. These people are at risk. Donald Trump, in fact, appears to be two hops away from the CPAC attendee. And it is a little bit worrying. And there could be some. There is a lot of potential chaos baked into the system right now over the next 6 months. I still think that we're going to find a vaccine and this is going to be treatable within 2 years or so. But in the next 6 to 9 months, I think we are potentially, at least, I think there's a reasonably good likelihood that we are in for a really rocky ride.
Nick, you just spent time in the Silicon Valley. A friend of mine who does a lot of business there said that his impression is that about 70% of all available brain space is being used on like long Twitter threads talking about the exponential risk of the coronavirus. What kind of feedback did you get?
I don't know if matcha lattes work as well as Purell on this, Matt, on 60% alcohol Purell or not.
If you put enough Everclear in a matcha latte, will become disinfectant.
Suderman might have served me that latte at some point.
Yeah, all it is a delivery mechanism for grain alcohol, for God's sake. No, I think in Peter's, you know, both fastidious but increasingly kind of hysterical, you know, calculations of we're really probably in for a very chaotic, possibly chaotic time. That's the attitude that I encountered in the Bay Area and in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And Matt, by the time I got back to New York, I flew out on a Friday or something. It seemed to have beaten me to New York. There is a lot of anxiety about this. And I think it's important, you know, first off, to recognize that the death rates are low. And as I talked to Ron Bailey last week in a For a Reason podcast interview, you know, what we're looking at here is basically something that is a severe flu season, you know, or a little bit worse than that.
It is likely to be significantly worse than that. No, if you listen to that entire
Gottlieb
interview.
Scott Gottlieb is not the only person who has an opinion about this. So, you know, and it's like, do we take Scott Gottlieb as gospel when we agree with him, I guess, and when we don't agree with him, then he's as idiotic about this as he is about vaping, right? I think it's a risk. But the more that we talk about it, and you know, what I would like to point out is the idea that we get in many cases when we're not talking about something like the Spanish flu, which had a 3 to 6% death rate from people who were infected, we get the pandemics that we want. And right now, what this is channeling is
who wants an intense any of them? Nobody wants any pandemics. That doesn't make any sense.
But Peter, what it means is that you know there is a social element to all of this stuff, right? So should we all just stay home and self quarantine for 6 weeks and then hopefully kill it or something like that, or what? You know, it's like you make different choices based on different risk assessments. What I'm saying is this is coming, and the media discussion of it is based on the fact that a large percentage of people are, you know, believe that Donald Trump is the most incompetent idiot who's ever occupied the White House. There's a strong case for that, and that because of that, something horrific has to happen on his watch. It didn't happen with World War. It didn't happen with this. And now it's going to be this, that this is coming from China, or, you know, which is now the new villain in everything that we talk about, because we're over Russia, because it turns out that Russia didn't really throw the election, and Russia isn't that big a threat to our way of life. Neither is Islamic terrorism, but China is. So everything coming out of China is awful and evil. And, you know, we're dealing with this on some level. There's been a record long economic expansion, which everybody knows can't go on forever. And at the same time, we don't want it to end. We're all kind of hoping for it to end. There is an election going on, which seems to be apocalyptic at the very least for baby boomers, because God fucking hope that it's the last baby boomer election where a baby boomer, or actually even somebody who's older than a baby boomer, gets into the White House. I think what we need to, you know, we need to think about the coronavirus in the context of those social anxieties, which are off the hook. And to me, that's the overreaction that's going on here. And what we're going to see is likely, as Jerry Tichilli pointed out in a piece at Reason, what this is a classic instance of crisis, of what's described in Robert Higgs's Crisis and Leviathan, where there is some kind of panic, there is some kind of moment where the government starts to say, at all levels, starts to say, you know what, we need to assert more control over more aspects of your life, because we're in a really, really serious crisis. When the crisis abates, somehow most, if not all, of the controls stay in place. That's what I'm most concerned about. I think we don't have as much of a fear of dying from this as we do of locking in the next level of kind of increased government that is just absolutely useless for anything other than centralizing power.
Look, I agree that there's going to be a lot of bad policy responses. We're already seeing a lot of talk about policy responses that I think
we haven't even talked about economic stimulus.
And are unlikely to be effective, even if you assume a sort of a Keynesian, you know, sort of a stimulus works kind of view of these things. We're going to see probably some overuse of state, local, maybe even federal power to keep people at home in some cases. And we absolutely should be worried about that. On the other hand, we should also be worried about responses that don't go far enough and that don't take this seriously enough. For example, we talked about one of the good things that the federal government can do is give guidance. And that, I think, is right, is give guidance and sort of give advice rather than say, this is what you must do. That's where we want the federal government and its experts to sort of be weighing in, is to suggest best practices. And health officials suggested, for example, they wanted to issue guidance telling seniors not to fly and to cancel travel. And President Trump and the White House overruled that because they thought that that would instill panic and collapse the economy. The economy is already hosed. The economy, like this is the Trump is not going to save the economy here, but he might save some lives by issuing correct guidance and allowing the health officials who actually know what they're talking about, unlike President Trump, to do their jobs.
Catherine, we saw 50 basis points shaved off the Federal Reserve on an emergency basis last week, which is immediately absorbed, spat out, and ignored by the markets, which continued to tank. Rather than put you on the spot to come up with the ideal Federal Reserve funds rate,
why wouldn't we do that?
Someone else.
You would do that to me.
Yes, I would. Talk a little bit about kind of the lack of preparation, not even in the specific terms of, you know, pandemic response, but the lack of flexibility put into the system, generally speaking, when we've been growing the size of government, we've been growing deficits to $1 trillion, even during an economic expansion. And now we look around and looking for a lever, and all the levers have withered. I tried to keep that metaphor. Wow. Did that make sense?
What did you just do?
I thought that made sense.
Withered like orphan limbs on a robot rabbit or
exactly
something.
Exactly
right. Come on,
yes,
please
exactly.
extend the metaphor.
Right. So this is something that we've talked about a lot in the past is, you know, in good times, when things are looking up, that is the right moment to implement austerity. That is the right moment to try to solve longstanding problems or resolve longstanding liabilities. This is true in all areas of life. This is true about personal finance. This is true if you're running a business. This is true if you're running a country. And we have now fully missed that window. and we are right back in the OMG zone. And Matt, you are quite right that I thought you were gonna not mix the metaphor, and I don't know why my hope would spring eternal like that. Like, I honestly, how can I not learn? But, you know, we have already pulled all the levers all the way. It's true. And, you know, this decision to cut rates by the Fed was the last little tweak that we could do. And now we're out of options, except for the one that we've been pursuing all along, which is just like lots more debt, lots more spending. We'll figure it out later. I will say I am generally not one of those libertarians who is very focused on the Fed. I just, you know, I get that there is a theory of the case that sees the Fed as kind of the original sin or kind of the core of a lot of our dysfunction. I have had that case made persuasively to me, but it is not a theory that I come back to over and over. However, this recent decision has nudged me a little more in the direction of the like end the Fed libertarianism. Like, it just looks to me, to my non-expert eyes, like a great example of sort of both too little, too late, and possibly an action that leans into and worsens the peaks and troughs of a cycle rather than smoothing them. I don't know, because you never have the counterfactual, right? You're never able to see what would have happened if the Fed hadn't acted. And I know that there are listeners to this podcast who have a much more refined understanding of how all of these dynamics work. And I would love to hear from you on the Twitters. But my bias here, seeing this decision this week, has been to feel a little bit more like these guys don't seem to be helping.
I think the bigger fear is or is going to come from the fiscal policy side, where, you know, we're already having all the wise men and wise ladies of Washington and of the commentariat talking about how we really need a stimulus now, because the economy is tanking because of this. Yes or no, that might be happening, but we need to, you know, immediately give everybody $1,000 to go spend on Purell and Kleenex. We're going to need to bail out the airline industries, maybe other types of destination or travel type industries and things like that. And what, you know, to build on what Catherine is saying, is that, you know, we did all of that over 10 years ago, and we never stopped doing that, and nobody cares. And it means that when you actually have a problem and you've been shooting bullets like 24/7, literally and figuratively, you know, it's like, well, you know what? We're kind of out of ammunition. I'm actually more interested in trying to find out or trying to assess what is the global economic effect of all of this, because when you have, you know, a country like China, which next to the US is the biggest economy in the world, is clearly going to be hammered by this, probably not, you know, not in the short term either. There was already a shift away from certain types of trade with China and putting plants and capital equipment in China. I think that is something that is, you know, a really major, major thing. When you see an economy like Italy, which is, you know, in the scope of things, in you know, it's not a massive economy, but in terms of the European economy, you know, it's or the EU, it's actually a significant player. And if the type of infection rates and economic slowdown that you see in Italy spreads to the EU, you know, we're looking at a very, very major kind of economic slowdown that could have a lot of, you know, really problematic outcomes for us.
I think the best case scenario in terms of the economy is just that we have 2 or 3 months where the travel sector, you know, the airline industry, hotels, the service sector are not quite shut down, but close, and that we just have a full quarter of lost revenue in the travel sector, and then all the economic ripple effects that come from that. When the airline industry suddenly doesn't have any money anymore, when all the hotels don't have any money anymore, when all of the tipped workers don't have any cash anymore, right? Like, think about South by Southwest times 10 weeks or 20 weeks, and in every city in the United States and maybe a lot of cities in Europe as well. I think that's the best case scenario.
That quote taken out of context is my nightmare. South by Southwest, but everywhere, always.
Right, but South by Southwest canceled
also,
everywhere.
But that's,
I understand.
That is also, it. I mean, this is where it becomes, I think, important not to oversell this, because it's not every city is Austin and not every, I don't know what the, ultimately, what is the economic effect of South by Southwest on Austin? And then when you get to cities where tourism or annual events are not, like convention stuff is not a big thing. And this is where I think, you know, libertarian skepticism towards power can cut in a lot of different ways, and can be nihilistic in a certain way. Well, it's like, you know, the government sucks at everything. It shouldn't be doing anything. That's a bad idea, but it is also clearly, I mean, we have to, everything that we are reading about has to be filtered through a massive bullshit detector that everyone in the media, for very different reasons, wants this to be as big a fucking deal as possible.
I don't know and if that's I true. I think that's absolutist, Nick. I don't want this to be the worst thing. I'm okay. In the media, you know? Like,
so
it's
the,
like
four
every,
us, the four of
everyone
us,
everyone in the media, no, it's a gross overstatement.
Yeah.
There's okay. People who are out there trying to do serious work on this. Some of them fall on the, like, oh my God, panic doom. Some of them don't. I mean, I just see in
everybody who wants Trump out of office wants this to be as big a deal
dude,
as possible.
You say Trump derangement syndrome all the damn time, which I think is problematic on its own.
You didn't let me finish. Fox News wants this to be as big a story as possible, especially
except
if they can blame it on the Wuhan, you know, the Wuhan race.
Except when
so
they
it's
don't,
like,
though. I mean, like, yeah, it's a, okay. there's, it's possible
you're right.
to get
I,
to
I take
an
it back.
TDS.
I will take it back, Matt, and I'll say that roughly 75% of the media, and particularly the legacy media, want this to be as big a deal as possible.
Hey, Nick, I want to see your underlying data there. I'd like to actually go through your research methods.
I have a
no, but actually, this is a great example of how conversations
share with you because I can only share it in person.
This is a great example of how conversations about statistics are really hard to productively have, right?
Like at least 72% of them just go wrong.
There's a big difference between everybody and 75%. There's a big difference between 0.2% and 2%. There's a big difference.
There's also,
and in
I
fact,
don't know, like talking figuratively or literally. So I take it back. The media is actually a very good, clear lens. And we should not have our bullshit detectors on because the media is just trying to do its job. It's
you're right, Nick. That's what we were saying. You've really correctly captured
the
other side.
The other.
That was a good steel, Manning. Thanks.
Yes.
This is something that Russ Roberts, blessed be he of Econ Talk fame, is really, really good on. When I was a young journalist just starting out and went on one of my very first junkets to Cape Cod to the Wiedenbaum Center retreat, they had a couple of sessions on how hard it is to think and talk, and especially how hard it is to communicate about statistics. That basically, if you say a number that is less than 2%, people just, the way human brains work is that we round that down to zero. And if you say a number that is greater than like 80%, the way that human brains work is that we round that up to definitely going to happen 100% certain. And this is just, it's a caveman problem. It's a faulty brain problem, and we are all suffering from it, and we are not better than cavemen, and we can try really, really hard to fight against it, and we should, but this is going to be how this discourse is. Like, small numbers round down to impossible until they round up to certain.
Hard shift. Let's go to politics. We had Super Tuesday less than 6 days ago, or 6 days ago, believe it or not.
Doesn't seem so super.
Joe Biden won more delegates so far, although they're still counting. That's not funny. That like was not worthy of laughter.
It was the tone.
All right. So anyways, Joe Biden won more delegates than Bernie Sanders, which is a result. I mean, like so far, they're going to count in California until the virus has wiped out all of the country. That result would have seemed absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah. When is Florida? I mean, like if they can push back Florida a couple days, you know. I mean, that could radically change the outcome.
The Michigan primary is Tuesday, and my God, go to your little 538 polling doohickey there and look at the difference between the Sanders versus Biden polling from seriously, 1 week ago until now, it's flipped. Biden was down more than 10 percentage points. Now he's up by like 15 percentage point in Michigan. We've had Michael Bloomberg finally dropped out. Elizabeth Warren finally dropped out. I think she's the only one who hasn't yet of the former candidates endorsed Joe Biden. Tulsi Gabbard's still out there. God bless her. Getting muscled off the debate stage by the DNC. But we're
basically being dead personed as both as a woman and a person of color. She doesn't count anymore.
What color is she?
She's she's like Polynesian, yeah. Right? Or
that's
something.
That's, so. That's the new color. No, but I'm, of
all, I'm, all I'm saying. I want to note that she is.
We got an outraged tweeter from a listener who is known to us and a reader who is known to us but shall remain unnamed, who did not enjoy our use of the phrase woman of color in reference to Tulsi. So just keep in mind there's debate out there in the libertarian
sphere. Person of color? Person of color?
At any rate, is this finally, at long last, Catherine Mangu Ward, America blinking at socialism? Did we look at Bernie Sanders? We came close. We ran through the simulations. We're like, my God, he might be the guy. And Democrats said, yeah, no, can't do it.
Yes, but also no. I'm going to go full Suderman here. I know, like, never go full Suderman, but here I am. And say that it looks like for this moment, exactly in this spot of time, we have indeed blinked. We have said, you know what, let's not do the socialism under the auspices of Bernie Sanders right this exact minute in this exact way. However, the horizon of the Democratic Party, the openness of the Overton window, the spectrum, choose your metaphor, has now become so much more socialist. We have moved so far in the direction of Medicare for all and other interventions in the economy in terms of a general mindset that is redistributionist and egalitarian and centralizing. And that is not going to go away. And so, like, even if Bernie Sanders loses, which it currently looks like he will, he's still going to win. And that's terrifying, although not as terrifying as Bernie Sanders being president in 1 year.
Can I just point out, by the way, that all of these discussions, like, we keep talking about the outcome of the Democratic race for president, for the nomination, as if it's all America. And so when people were like, you know what, America wasn't ready for Elizabeth Warren because she was a woman, it's like, no, Democrats, people who vote in Democratic primaries, so the party faithful of Democrats who at last gasp, that last count by Gallup, 27% of people in America said they were Democrats. A small portion of those were people who vote in primaries, and they said no to Elizabeth Warren. They're in the process of saying no to Bernie Sanders. So I do think it's worth keeping in mind that all of these discussions, which somehow are about America writ large, are actually about a subset of people in America.
Well, that's why I'm using this language about Overton windows and such, right? Yeah. I'm not saying that the probability is 100%, but
you're saying it's like 80%.
It's like 80%, so mentally rounded up to 100%. No, but this is how we set the outside. This is how we set the outside edge of the realm of possibility to the left in this country, roughly speaking, is that we do a Democratic primary, and then we see what that fraction of that fraction can tolerate. And their answer this cycle is something much different and more radical than
no woman but Medicare for all.
Just no Elizabeth Warren. It's not the same thing.
I don't know, because Hillary Clinton clearly was never the nominee of that party either. This is something we learned over the past week.
Let's try to ease up on the sarcasm. Suderman, you've talked a lot about how Joe Biden is not a moderate. Tell us why.
Because he doesn't do moderate things. Look, he is a moderate when you compare him to Bernie Sanders. It's true. He's not a socialist. He wants to tax less and spend less than Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And so Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders defined the outer edge of big government progressive policy. And Bernie Sanders, I think it is completely fair to call it socialist, or at least democratic socialist policy, given that that is how Sanders himself defines it. And Joe Biden isn't those things. What he is, however, is the most progressive big government leftmost, like presuming he's the nominee, he would be the leftmost nominee for a major political party, at least in modern history. His proposals add up to the most tax hikes. He is proposing more tax hikes than Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, more spending than either of them. And because Biden is such an avatar of the Democratic Party, he's been around for forever. He's run for president. You know, he's been running for president since I was 7, maybe 6 years old. I'm the youngs on this side, on this podcast here. I'm not that young. I'm 38. And he's been running for 30 plus of those years for president. And so he has been around the Democratic Party and always kind of been a point man for whatever the Democratic Party is into at the moment, right? So he was on the Judiciary Committee in the 1980s. He spearheaded criminal justice reform in the 1990s, the opposite of that. He spearheaded
criminal justice deform.
Right, like expanded sentences in tough on crime policies in the 1990s. He was the point man for the stimulus under Barack Obama, right? He's just always been kind of the Democratic Party's go-to guy for the thing that they're doing, which means that you can, in some ways, use him almost like a survey, right? Like in the way that you a survey of the country, you use just a couple of thousand people, respondents, to say what the whole country is like. You can use Joe Biden, you survey Joe Biden and find out what the Democratic Party, or at least the establishment, is like. And what the establishment is like right now is not socialist, but into a lot more spending, a lot more taxation, a lot more regulation than has been in the last 30 or 40 years, for sure. And that is worrying.
I would add to that that actually Biden, though, is, you know, and this is true of Trump as well, that they are actually lagging indicators of where the country is, because everything that Peter was talking about that Biden was into, and I'd throw in the RAVE Act, you know, because he is not simply a go-along voter in the war on drugs. He is one of the major architects. He also helped create legislation that led to the creation of the Drug Czar's Office back in the 80s. He is a terrible establishment politician, but he perfectly represents the move towards bigger, more expansive government. And what I would say, though, is he's talking about taxing people more now. When you even look at somebody like Barack Obama, Obama ultimately went along with certifying most of George Bush's tax cuts, which, going back to the 2000 election, recognize and remember that both Al Gore, if we still remember him at all, but both Al Gore and George W. Bush campaigned on cutting taxes. Bush's were bigger tax cuts, but both wanted it. I think from a libertarian point of view, one of the things to think about, because Donald Trump is a big government conservative. He has, under his watch, the amount of money that government spends, independent of our ability to pay for it, has increased significantly by, you know, $1,441 per person, according to a New York Times tally of all of that. Revenues are down, but it's also revenues are up. But they're down, but they're still down in terms of deficit spending. And so what we see, and I think this is something libertarians need to fully kind of embody and then figure out, how do we turn this around? Under Republicans and under Democrats, the government does more and spends more again and again and again, and it increases debt. And we are not, part of our problem, I think, is that we're not pushing against, oh, well, the Republicans are bad and, you know, they win an election, or the Democrats. This is the way that the country has been going since, you know, at least Richard Nixon, basically. I mean, there was that brief respite in the 90s, which is important. And maybe that's where we need to go back and figure out, how did government spending as a percentage of GDP decline? How did, you know, at least the rudimentary balance between government outlays and revenues come into being? What do we do about entitlements? Because this is not about Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It's much bigger than that. And it all points to ruin, or, you know, a major, major screw up and cataclysm from, you know, what government is offering now versus what it's going to be able to in another 10 or 15 years.
I think it's worth just briefly pulling this back to the discussion of coronavirus and the policy responses to it. Let's say that you are a center-left economist type, and you think that fiscal stimulus, the government spending money in times of crisis, is an idea that basically works and has a bunch of sound research behind it. Even if you are of that view, what we have done over the past decade plus is run deficits so high that we'd no longer have the ability to do that in a way that would make it work, according to the sort of, you know, the kind of basic Keynesian idea about how stimulus is supposed to work, because we've been by running. And so this has sort of been a theme of the Congressional Budget Office reports on the deficit and the debt and how it just keeps getting bigger, especially under Trump, is that having that debt overhang and having those high deficits in good times has made it very difficult for us to mount a policy response in bad times when they come, and they will come. And so, this is a kind of an alarm that reason has been sounding now for years, is that when you run up these deficits and when you let debt just sort of continue to grow like this, what you do is you limit this, your space for action, even under, again, like I said, even if you're sort of a conventional Keynesian who thinks fiscal stimulus is a good idea. And in fact, I think that fiscal stimulus is wildly overrated at best. And then there's this other problem with it right now, which is, what is fiscal stimulus supposed to do under the best of circumstances? It's supposed to stimulate demand. So you give people money and then they buy stuff and that gets the economy going again. That doesn't work in a situation where the real problem is that nobody is making anything. And if nobody is making anything because people can't go to work, because they're not traveling, because productivity is down, because global supply chains have been broken, then it doesn't matter if you give them an extra $1,000 or an extra $5,000, because they're not going to have stuff to spend it on, and they're not going to be able to go anywhere and go to restaurants and spend their money. And so just in terms of the kind of the stimulus aspect of this and the policy responses, we have both eliminated the ability to respond in the way that a lot of center-left economists might sort of traditionally say we should to an economic crisis, but also it's not going to work this time, and we are going to have to be a lot smarter about trying to figure out something that will work and trying to see what we can do here, because I, like I said, think the economic toll here over the next several months and perhaps the next several years is likely to be quite bad.
Doom. Catherine, before we pour a 40 out, in the morning on the both the Democratic campaign and specifically Elizabeth Warren's candidacy, as memorialized on Saturday Night Live once again this weekend, you and Nick both kind of alluded to the sort of the reaction among many people to Warren dropping out, that this was an indicator of a certain amount of, at best, a deep preference for lady folk, at worst, kind of a misogyny and sexism. What say you to that analysis? Or let's say, put it this way, is it true that 75% of all political journalists absolutely were fangirling over Elizabeth Warren and have been beclowning themselves ever since?
Yes to that last thing. I'm not sure about the de-preferencing of ladies or whatever that phrase was that you just used.
It was pretty good.
I commend to our listeners Katie Herzog of Seattle's The Stranger, her very first piece for Reason, which is titled "Sexism Didn't Kill the Warren Campaign, The Warren Campaign Killed the Warren Campaign." That is basically my view as well. Katie, for those of you who do not know her, is an absolutely super cool debunker, troublemaker, shit stirrer on Twitter, who is also definitely not a libertarian, and who in many ways could have been well positioned to be a classic Warren voter, but
she says she started out liking Elizabeth Warren in the piece,
did not end up as a Warren voter, and her trajectory is instructive. She does not hate ladies. In fact, she likes them more than most people.
You know, the way to, I think, reframe everything in the past 4 years, including Trump, is really to blame everything on Hillary Clinton when you think about it. Because she had the easiest possible win, like path to the White House imaginable, and she screwed it up. And as a result of that, everybody is coming up with like theories to explain that away. And Hillary has her own thing, and she wrote her book, which was awful. She has a documentary series that she produced that's on, you know, Netflix or Hulu or something like that, which is pushing all of that. You know, then the Bernie Sanders people are now saying, oh, well, she wasn't left-wing enough, and that's why, you know, we need to become socialists. And then all of the Trump tards are pushing the idea that, oh, what, you know, what the 2016 election, you know, where a guy barely got into office. It, you know, it's an absolute mandate to turn into some kind of economic nationalism, which ends somehow with a bunch of small readership conservatives saying, you know, the really important thing is that we get back to an America where women aren't allowed to leave the household so that they can take care of their kids when they're not sent to school because of coronavirus. It's all Hillary Clinton's fault at this point. That's what I will say about 2020.
All right, let's shift to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming business, Catherine?
My recommendation is timely for two reasons. The first reason is that yesterday was the 42nd anniversary of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is the most relevant anniversary for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It is technically the anniversary of the radio show, which is how the thing started out. For those of you who have not read Douglas Adams' masterworks, I strongly recommend that you do so. They feature, among other things, the phrase, "Don't panic," which is good advice for our times, and also the name of Neil Gaiman's book about Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So,
but you're also supposed to bring a towel.
Bring a towel.
Because it's important to be prepared.
And there's a lot of stuff about cocktails, so Suderman relevant. But these are, of course, wacky adventures set in a slightly alternate universe where there's some interstellar, accidental, and on-purpose travel, and you should bring a towel. But yes, I just want to emphasize the combination of Neil Gaiman, everybody's favorite, my favorite, Nick Gillespie clone. He wears all black. He has cool hair. He has a cult following. He's moderately annoying, and he and he writes really well. He writes really well. And he is, of course, the author of American Gods, the Sandman series, and many others. He is also the biggest Douglas Adams fanboy, and it comes across in this book, which is fun, delightful, a quick read, not, I would say, extremely well structured. So you kind of want to get in there only if you are already a fan of both men, but I am, and many of reasons listeners probably are as well.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
As mentioned previously, I watched Face Off, the 1997 John Woo action thriller featuring, it's really peak Nicolas Cage and peak late career John Travolta, where John Travolta I don't know what he is, like he might be an FBI agent, he's some kind of cop who has to have an experimental face transplant with Nicolas Cage to find a ticking time bomb that's going to blow up in L.A. Back when L.A. was still big enough of a town to be the possible target of international terrorism.
Watch it.
It is a fantastic movie, but my main thing was that I've read Lee Drutman's Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. He is a political scientist who has a interesting theory about what happens when you get two parties in a system like America's, where they are essentially perfectly sorted into a conservative and liberal party as we have, and why that is a problem. It's a very, very interesting and good book. The one thing, and I hope to talk with him about it at some point in the near future, but he believes that a government that is not regularly passing major transformational legislation is somehow a failed democracy, as opposed to one that is maybe perfectly representing the will of the people, and that the people are just really awful and deserve what kind of pandemic that they get. But Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America by Lee Drutman.
Suderman, what kind of pandemics have you been consuming?
I have been watching The Outsider, which is aired on HBO, a 10-episode series that ended last night based on a Stephen King novel of the same name. It's fantastic and great. It's by it was developed by Richard Price, and then also and stars Ben Mendelsohn, and it is a supernatural crime show that has a little bit of a kind of a pandemic, sort of coronavirus adjacent twist to it, in that it is the detectives end up realizing that they are on the trail of a killer who spreads virally, and that you can kind of catch murder. And the show has gotten, I think, positive, but also somewhat, but not glowing reviews. But I really liked it. And so I'm a fan of Stephen King's novels. And King, of course, has been adapted a zillion times. I mean, I think there were at least three Stephen King movies that came out just last year. And this is by far, I think, the most King-like Stephen King adaptation I believe I have ever seen. It just sort of gets all of those King tropes and the King-type characters who are haunted by their own demons as well as perhaps real demons. The ways that King's characters are incredibly gripping, they're not super complex, but he writes these characters that are just super engaging because they're always spinning out worst-case scenarios, always sort of imagining what the most horrible thing that could happen is, or in some cases, what the best thing could happen is. But there's a sort of maximalism to his characters' imaginations that's always spinning. And so his books are so interesting to read because you see them. They're the kind of one-note characters, but they're always thinking about the thing they most want in the world, the thing they fear the most, the thing that could ruin everything, right? And it's often a really mundane sort of everyday thing. And then, of course, it always ends up being something more than that, something bigger and more horrific. And this show just sort of gets that and then blends it with a kind of traditional dark crime drama in ways that really work well. The acting's excellent. It's got, like I said, Ben Mendelsohn, Jason Bateman is in the show for a while. And I highly recommend it. I'm a little surprised it hasn't gotten more attention in terms of prestige TV series, because it's one of the better shows I've seen in a while, and it has a pretty satisfying ending.
When I was on a vacation, when I was on holiday from this podcast, and I believe Suderman was taking the point guard role, then I was part of my vacationing was at a delightful place, not totally well known among people outside of the state of California, called Knott's Berry Farm.
Oh my gosh, right-wing boysenberry magnate's legacy.
Thank you. If you have ever eaten a boysenberry, it came from boysenberry jam. It came from this farm in Buena Park, California. Anyways, yeah. This is a Disneyland adjacent amusement park that is several rungs lower on the Imagineering scale. And I hadn't been,
but several rungs higher on the right wing anti communist stuff.
I don't know. Walt Disney was competing.
Talk to Brian Dougherty about Knott, the namesake there. He was a real, like, hey, UNICEF, you know, collecting pennies on Halloween for UNICEF is a world, you know, one world government plot.
This will probably then put this in a nice sharp relief, what I'm going to recommend about it in particular. But anyways, this is a Disneyland adjacent place. When I was a kid, and I hadn't been there since I was a kid, it was mostly... You know, they'd expanded the farm and they had this chicken dinner restaurant. And they had a lot of this Old West stuff. You go in a mining kind of thing and you had the saloons and you can get your picture in like Old West costumes and these kind of things. And then they started adding crazy roller coasters and the Camp Snoopy, and it became a full fledged amusement park. And so I went back with my kids and thinking, like, of course they're not going to have the Old West crap, because like it's been 35 years and people don't do that in California anymore. And no, they still had all the Old West crap specifically. And this is what delighted me about this the most on that trip. They have this thing called the Old West Museum at Knott's Berry Farm, which is, I mean, museum is a strong word. It's a collection of weird things, and it's all like in this kind of ye old west kind of hagiography, or this is the rosy glow of what Western expansion looked like. But like the curios are really interesting, like little figurines of people carved out of avocado pits from the 19 teens, and like travel brochures and like cigarette cards of ladies in the Old West and an 1850s like a fire putting out carriage. And it ends up by this old all this time kind of running through the cycle of kitsch into, like, I'm still glad that there are collections left like this around, because they are anachronistic, but at this point they have a lot of stuff that's really interesting to look at. So if you happen to go to Knott's Berry Farm and want to sit down and let your kid go on the death drop or whatever and just kind of geek out on some pretty cool Old West memorabilia and stuff by right-wing lunatics, it's right there. Go check it out. And that's all the right-wing lunacy that we have time for here. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable. We will see you again next week, or at least most of us. We'll see us again next week, depending on the level of doom and panic. And keep listening to reason.com/podcasts, including Nick's great Reason interview with Nick Gillespie's on Wednesdays. And that's it. Thanks. Goodbye.
Man, we are really, really not social distancing here in this little coronavirus spread box thing. Yeah. I mean, CDC does not approve.
Yeah, we're doing the opposite of that.
That foam is going to keep the coronavirus alive for
I think if we could just figure out how to make the foam slightly moist, we could really probably...